Beth, and I'm a psychological wellbeing practitioner from Newcastle. I just wanted to say the biggest thank you to the contributors of the Clinical Psychologist Collective book. I've enjoyed reading this so much and loved having an insight into the range of backgrounds and experiences people have prior to applying for the doctorate. And it's been really interesting seeing the potential barriers to the application as well and how I can try and work around this. I really started to doubt myself and whether I was good enough to apply for the clinical psychology doctorate, but this has really given me the confidence boost that I needed to give it a shot. So the biggest thank you ever.
Coming up in today's episode, psychology meets politics. Join us as we chat with a trainee clinical psychologist on a really exciting placement in the world of Westminster, UK politics. Get ready as we explore the fascinating mashup of policymaking, mental health, and a good bit of political drama. Our guest for today gives us the lowdown on the corridors of power and how carving out a placement in such a niche area has become a possibility. I hope you find this intriguing episode about the intersection of psychology and politics so useful. Welcome along to the Aspiring Psychologist podcast. I am Dr. Marianne Trent, and I'm a qualified clinical psychologist. If you're new to the podcast or to the channel for that matter, please do take a moment to rate and review, like and subscribe. We create incredibly interesting, useful, engaging content that helps you be aware of developing trends in psychology and in mental health, and maybe illuminates and explores areas you'd not considered before. I'm really excited to bring you today's episode, which is with a trainee clinical psychologist in the third and final year of their placement. It's not your average placement, but it is really, really interesting. I hope you will find it to be so, and I look forward to catching up with you on the other side. Just want to welcome along our guest for today, Bradley Powell. Hi, Bradley.
Hi, Marianne, and thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's really nice to have you here. I've been so excited, looking forward to meeting you. I first heard about the role that you're doing via reading the Psychologist magazine, because I think I saw an article written by your predecessor in your placement. But we'll come on to think more about your extra special, very exciting, very interesting placement in a moment. Firstly, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what stage of your psychology journey you're at?
So I'm currently in my final year of the doctorate at Royal Holloway. And it's quite funny when you ask someone, can you tell me a little bit about yourself? There was one interview I had previously where I just, you know, smashed off my career experience. And then I thought it was quite a good answer. And I got to the end and they said, oh, but what do you like to do in your free time? but I think really, for me, I'm in the final year and currently working in Parliament. In my first year, I was in IAPT or NHS talking therapies, and that was a really good experience for me, as prior to the doctorate, I didn't have that much clinical experience, as in delivering therapy. My experience was more as a support worker, as a research assistant, and then working in a kind of like a strategic network. So when I started the doctorate and going into IAPT, it kind of gave me a really good grounding in how to give therapy. But when I did start, I do remember looking around thinking, well, I've got nothing compared to everyone around here. Everyone else has been a PWP before. Some people have done like a PhD or done amazing work as an assistant psychologist. Whereas my AP role, I didn't really do clinical work. It was more project related stuff. But I think starting anything new, those feelings of kind of like imposter syndrome, I think everyone has them. I actually had it less starting the doctorate compared to when I started in Parliament and being one of the only psychologists in there. I kind of thought, what have I got to add here? Everyone else has done politics at uni. They've been here for years. And I felt like a rabbit in the headlights, basically. I'm currently doing my thesis as well. So that's due in May. It's going quite well, I think. Systematic review is basically ready for publication, and then powering on with the empirical paper as well. So generally, things are going quite well. Of course, I'm looking forward to finishing the doctorate. I was kind of visualizing that a couple of days ago, and that gave me quite a positive feeling. So yeah, it's a pleasure to share a bit of my story with you today and your audience too.
Oh, thank you. So it sounds like you're almost daring to see, to kind of see where you're going, and actually by the time this academic year is out, you know, this chapter of your life will be drawing to a close. And you know, I think certainly having been a trainee myself, you at some point you just have to get your head down and just keep going and just keep going. But you're kind of lifting your head a little bit and thinking, oh, there is actually a life the other side of this.
Yeah, the thought of having a life on the other side of this, and I do try to maintain a good work-life balance as well, but in the current phase of doing the thesis, that does become a bit more consuming. But I do like to stick my head above the parapet and see what's going on the other side. And I think it's quite helpful for me, or it has been throughout the doctorate actually, because my fiance has been the year above me, so she's qualified. I've seen her living the qualified life, and I thought, yeah, could do with a bit of that.
Two psychologists in one house, gosh. Love that. I love that. Some existential conversations happening there, I'm sure. I also loved that when you were speaking about your systematic review, you were like, yeah, that's ready for publication. I love that. That's like, that is taking control. Like we're going straight to publication. Will you do that before your Viva? Is that kind of the plan?
That's definitely the plan. And I've heard that getting it published before the Viva gives you a bit more confidence when you go into it. So I think that would be quite a nice feeling. But really for me, I didn't want to spend all this time doing my thesis and then for it to just sit there if it could be published. And for me personally, I found once you've written the 12,000 word systematic review, you've done the majority of the work. You just need to cut it down and submit it. And then we can see what their publishers might want changing. But I think for me, I've always kind of planned my time in advance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, months in advance, I'll be thinking, right, this is my time to do this. And I try not to go over that. I always try to stick to those deadlines and make it happen. So I had it on my radiator October, November, December, a plan for each month. And sometimes the plan changes, but following that template kind of helps.
Amazing. Gosh, you're very driven, very self-accountable, which is incredible. I've really enjoyed seeing your name in my diary for months. We planned this in, like specifically for towards the end of your placement, didn't we? So that it would kind of, you kind of be able to reflect on your journey. So lovely. Shall we have a think about what your placement is? Like, if someone is listening to this and they're like, why is psychology involved in politics? You know, how's that happened? What would your answer to that be?
I think that there's two parts to this answer. So the first part is, how has this even happened? So when I first started the doctorate, I spent the previous year working for the Psychological Professions Network, and I was there at a conference talking about leadership for aspiring psychologists after I did the Edward Jenner program. And at that conference, my supervisor, the only psychologist MP, was there speaking at the conference. So naturally, what do you do after that? You network, you introduce yourself. And I basically said it would be fantastic to come and learn a bit more about Parliament with you. I put my supervisor and my course in touch, and that kind of led to the start of this placement coming about. And it was only really through, I guess, seeing the opportunity and being interested and taking that step forward is how it happened in some ways. But I think there has always been a desire in psychology anyway that we should be more involved in politics. And my supervisor wouldn't have been elected as a politician if her constituents didn't think Parliament needed a psychologist too. So I think it's definitely helpful for a psychologist to be in Parliament. And for me, what I've really got out of it is learning how the system works, how to maybe influence some policy, and as a trainee psychologist, I think it's really important that we do engage with politics or learn how to influence policy. So imagine you are conducting your research project. Perhaps you could be researching any health condition, and you've come up with, you've identified quite a novel finding that actually it shouldn't just be published in a journal. This should change some sort of policy. Well, working in here teaches you how maybe you could go about influencing that policy, whether it's giving you the confidence to go and meet with a politician or different policymakers, or asking parliamentary questions and building up that kind of network in the policymaking landscape to affect change. And that's really important for us as psychologists, because the policies that come out of government impact our service users and they impact us. So why on earth should we not be in that room trying to make that difference? But it is something that we're not learning about at undergrad or master's or doctorate level. But I would argue that it's something we should learn about from an earlier stage in our training.
Or just in our general education. You know, I don't feel like I was ever really taught about politics. I feel like I've been a bit politics thick, really, growing up. Like, I feel like knowing a bit more, you know, even now in schools, they kind of make them watch news round before they go home. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite useful, because they're at least hearing a child appropriate understanding of what's happening in the world. And I don't think we did that. And we turned news round off because it was boring. but they're just, I think they are making children more aware of the issues that are concerning them. So, you know, when we're thinking about key performance indicators and placement goals for time on placement, I'm guessing a placement in Westminster looks very different than one in an adult mental health service, for example. How do you navigate what it is you're hoping to achieve by the time you've finished a placement there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, of course, I'm not working with different presenting issues or different clinical models. Some of the things that I have been trying to do are more project related. So, for example, working on a campaign to protect the psychologist title and thinking about how we could maybe implement that change. So perhaps we can have a conversation after this about how that could pan out. So planning that campaign, and not just that campaign, but actually helping lots of different other stakeholders who want to change a policy, whether it's related to health or social care. So for example, yesterday I was meeting with a veterinary group who actually have a similar problem to psychology, in that they need to change the legislation. They need to have an increase in the workforce, and they're trying to influence Parliament. So meeting with different lobbying groups and just learning how to influence the system is something that's quite important for my development here, I'd say. There's also research projects that we want to get involved in. So at the moment, we are looking at best practice in disability policy across European parliaments to see whether there's any best practice initiatives that perhaps we could adopt in the UK Parliament. So trying to increase the number of people with disabilities working in Parliament to make it more accessible. So that's another project. I mean, it really is quite broad and varied. And another thing at the moment is developing some performance workshops for political candidates, parliamentary staff, and perhaps councillors. And it was quite interesting when I was having the meeting with the university about how, as a psychologist, for me now anyway, you take it for granted about CBT or kind of psychological principles. And then when you start talking to other people about them, about how, for example, our thoughts can influence how we feel and then our results, people stop and think, oh yeah, I've never thought about that. Of course that's an issue. So delivering some sort of performance workshops and disseminating psychological information there is another thing that I'm working on. And of course I probably try and write an article for the BPS at some point too.
Please do. I'll look forward to reading that. So, for those who are watching on YouTube, you will have seen my face light up when Bradley told us that he was working on trying to protect the title of psychologist. So, that is something I'm passionate about. For anyone that's listening to this, that's like, what do you mean, protect the title of psychologist? It's actually currently in the UK, totally legal for anybody with zero potentially psychology knowledge or qualifications to call themselves a psychologist, and there's nothing that can be done about that. And I've been ranting on about it for quite some time, but I've taken a very interested effort on social media, even within the last 7 days, of really trying to stir up some support for this campaign. Of course, it's largely professionally qualified psychologists who are getting behind this. I do believe later today I even have a chat booked in with a Radio 4 producer about this very issue. It needs to happen, it really needs to happen. And my reasoning for why this needs to happen is because people are out there, especially on social media. Somebody described mental health as being the next gold rush, because there's such a demand for it. And when there's a gold rush, people go out there with their pans, don't they, panning for gold? And it feels like that's what's happening with the term psychologist. So you get people on TikTok, on Instagram, wherever, punting themselves out there as a psychologist. But when you dig, they may have a psychology degree, which, as we know, is theory based only, and doesn't necessarily involve any clinical contact or supervision, and certainly no regulation. And they're calling themselves a psychologist, and ethically they feel that's appropriate. But of course, what we know is that the general public think that if someone is calling themselves a psychologist, that they mean professionally qualified. And that's where the grey area is for me.
Absolutely. And the one of the hard things about this problem is that the people who do call themselves psychologists are well-meaning. Okay, maybe there is the gold rush problem, but they're well-meaning. They're trying to help other people. But actually, if you're not trained in the evidence-based approach and you haven't been assessed and delivering that to an effective level, then actually you could be doing more harm as well. And I think it's fantastic that you're speaking to Radio 4 because as psychologists, we can want that change to happen. But really, the calls to make that change will be so much more powerful if it's the public behind the campaign. And it's really difficult as a member of the public to find a qualified professional who's going to provide the best treatment for your care when everyone's marketing themselves as, I can treat this. But actually, are they going to be treating your problems with the nice recommended treatments? Probably not. So I think it's really important that we do that work. And when we speak with other countries, they're completely shocked that we don't have the psychologist title protected. So I think it's really a matter of time before we make it happen. And we need to do it sensitively as well, because academic psychologists, people who work in universities, naturally they may not want the title to be protected because they've worked very hard doing their psychology degree, PhD, and their research. And potentially protecting the title could impact on their ability to call themselves a psychologist. But I don't think we should let that stop us from trying to protect the public from this issue. And I'm sure there's ways around of actually making sure that every psychologist can be called a psychologist in a way that's safe and ethical for the public.
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree more. And I love the idea of getting the public behind what you do, so that I think it's probably, it's like the drama about the post office campaign that happened recently, for the Horizon scandal. This became a public movement. The public were demanding that something be done, weren't they? I think the problem is there hasn't been big enough case studies to demonstrate why this is problematic. Currently, I think the more and more the unregulated, unqualified psychologists go on, there will be harm to people as a result of what is being propagated. And I would love to think that everybody has got the best will behind what they're doing, but some of the stuff I've been watching recently, oh, it's so wildly unethical and non-evidence based that, the passive income products spring up off the back of that, and it feels like it's mainly driven in trying to line their pockets rather than genuinely ease the distress of the general population. So I think it's very tricky. And of course, we get lots and lots of resistance for this movement from experts by experience who are, of course, putting content out there as well. But I still think, generally speaking, a sensitively positioned, professionally qualified, regulated, insured mental health professional is a best place to start with anything that you're trying to do to change the way you feel about your mental health. Anyway, this is a slightly protracted I'm just very passionate about this, and of course it really is political. I know that Australia and New Zealand, their title is protected, and I think that's possibly more recent. Like, I don't know if we ever piggyback off other countries' guidance and policies. Does that happen, Bradley?
I think it's funny, actually. I was at an event last night. It was actually about finances and how Australia developed a really innovative system for reducing the complexities with certain financial exchanges. And off the back of that, we're trying to implement that in the UK because it will save time and money. So I think that there's definitely a case of learning from other institutions and places and seeing how we can do what we do better. But it is quite funny as well, because working in Parliament, when I first started, I kind of felt like I was learning a completely new role. So I came in and I didn't have my kind of CBT crutch or my prior foundations that when you go into a different service, you know how the NHS works, you kind of know what you'll be doing. So I was really trying to immerse myself in this political, parliamentary environment, taking in all of this knowledge. And about 2 months in, I received a message from a family friend who is trying to find a psychologist. And they showed me the link to the person that they had been seeing before, who said they could no longer help them. And this person, unfortunately, wasn't really providing the evidence-based approach for the difficulty that they were having. So I kind of provided a text message summary of what I thought would help. And after I sent it, it was probably a bit of an essay on that text. It kind of reminded me of how lucky I am to actually be trained as a psychologist and to be able to share that information. And it kind of regrounded me in Parliament as well, because I'm coming in here not as someone with a politics background. I'm coming in here with a clinical research background, and I think that adds something so much more as well.
It really does, and I think it probably helps quieten down the imposter syndrome a little bit, because you're not being expected to go in there as a fully fledged established politician. You know, you might well have had to go suit shopping before this placement. You know, this might not have been something that was already in your wardrobe for this placement. Like, but you are seen as the mental health expert, and that's why you're there, you know, and you're allowed to be the expert in that area and learn and grow in others.
Definitely. It's funny how you say that. So on my first day, going for the placement visit, I get on, you know, my smartest work outfit that I would have used previously. Very rarely wear a blazer for a placement day. Maybe I've done that once for a staff party. So anyway, I put on my chinos, my nice shirt, my blazer, and I get there and I see Big Ben, and you know, it's a fantastic environment to be in. But then I realize, looking around, everyone else is in suits. I think I'm underdressed. So I think there's something to be said of, you know, dressing up, wearing the suit. It does make you feel like you fit in a bit more as well. So yeah, I did go suit shopping after that, but yeah, it was a funny way to start the placement.
I always prefer to be overdressed for any occasion. I never like to feel like you're the one, oh, I've got this horribly wrong. I'm in my joggers. Oh no, oh, no, this is terrible. All right, so I've got so many questions I want to ask you. Before I ask you my slightly more frippery, silly questions, could you give us another example of kind of something that you do on day to day on placement days? Are they all in person placement days in your placement?
Yes, they're all in person. It's So it could be quite varied, but let's say as an example, meeting. So for example, there could be an issue in society that people are trying to change. And one way of going about trying to effect that change is to ask parliamentary questions, to write early day motions. And these are things that kind of raise awareness about an issue in Parliament. So you could, I could meet with a stakeholder, understand the problem, and then draft this question to be submitted to be answered by a politician. And likewise with early day motions as well. There was another time where I've had to write a speech on a topic that would be delivered, and not being an expert in the area it was delivered in, you're working with the stakeholders as well to get their views on what they think should be incorporated in the speech. And that was quite a nice use of my writing skills, really. There's also lots of events going on in Parliament. So, you know, every day there's all sorts of different events. But one of the ones that I went to recently, which I really enjoyed, was a awareness raising event. And as I went in there, I was speaking with clinicians and people who have been affected by this condition as well. And it really reminded me of, as a psychologist, you really can understand the problems that a person has been through, possibly a bit more than other people without that clinical background, or you're able to validate the kind of difficulties that they have had and build those relationships up quite easily. Not easily, but yeah, it's helpful having that kind of psychological background there. If you are as a constituent, you could also write to your MP as well and get in touch with them. So sometimes a constituent might write with certain problems. Maybe they're having an issue with accessing NHS appointments, and then you can kind of liaise with them and with the relevant service to try and make that change happen. And that's more of the psychological type of work that we can do here. And outside of that as well, sometimes my friends and associates might want to come and see Parliament. So I've given them tours before. And it was quite funny, actually. On Monday, we were sat in the House of Lords, and the Lords is quite an impressive room to sit in. And my friend peers over the balcony because you're kind of out of the way. And he goes, "Oh, that's Lord Cameron there, Brad." And I go, "I don't believe you." And he goes, no, honestly, look." And it was the first day David Cameron had been made a Lord and was delivering his speech. So it's really it's really varied, the work that we're doing there. And it's quite fascinating walking around the estate. The kind of sense of history and awe is really powerful. I've become a bit habituated to it now. So that's what's nice, to do a tour and be reminded of how lucky I am to be there. And as I've been walking around, I have had a few smiles from people, and I thought, oh, were they smiling at me? So yeah, you see lots of people with impressive careers as well. So it's a really great place to be working. I do feel lucky.
Sounds amazing. And it sounds like you're actually watching history unfold, you know? It sounds like a really incredible privilege. Was it a very popular placement? Did you have to fight people off for it, or because you kind of found your supervisor, were you first in line?
I'm not too sure. I think one of the requirements is, as a trainee psychologist, you must hit, and I know you know this, but you must hit all of your competencies by the end of training. And as I started my first year and I met the supervisor, and that's when the placement started being formed, I knew exactly what I wanted to be doing in my final year. So that didn't necessarily guarantee that I'd be able to do this placement, but I did have that prior connection and the motivation to go out and try and hit all of my competencies before my final year. And I was quite lucky, I think, really being in a placement where I was able to work with some older adults in my adult service. I was able to work with some of the other competencies in my forensic placement. So I think I was really lucky with the placements I was in. It aligned well, but also looking for those opportunities and trying to make it happen to make sure that I did hit all of my competencies as well.
Amazing. So you had your eye on the prize you wanted to get, and so made sure that you'd met your milestones before you got there. One of my questions was going to be, have you been in the House of Lords? Have you been in the House of Commons? But like, I think you're like, yeah, like loads of times.
Yeah, I have been a few times. Recently, one of the hard debates to go and see is Prime Minister's Questions, which is every Wednesday, 12. And I'd never really watched it before, to be honest, maybe a highlight on the news. But since I've started working here, it's a great one to watch. And in all of our offices, we've got TVs, so you can see debates unfolding. You don't need to leave your office. But Prime Minister's Questions is naturally the busiest one, and you actually need to get book tickets. But I was able to make it recently. There was one spare seat left on that day, and it was quite an eventful debate. Yeah. But there's so much history in the Commons as well. So, for example, if I am walking around and giving a tour, before you walk into the Commons, there's a part which was actually hit by a bomb in World War II. And rather than completely recreating the archway of this door, they've remade it out of the rubble to represent resilience. So there is history, and you do get to see lots of the estate.
Sounds just so fascinating. I'm reading a book that's actually set in World War II at the moment. It's historical fiction, but I think, yeah, it's just so interesting. So interesting. Have you met the Prime Minister?
I haven't met the Prime Minister, no, but if there's an opportunity to do so, then that would be fantastic. Rolling back to the House of Lords as well, when you walk behind the Lords, actually, there's a part in my little script for a tour where you get in there and you say, now, just to let you know, all those years ago, you're now stood on the spot where Guy Fawkes laid the gunpowder. And every year before the parliamentary session commences, the basement is checked to make sure there's no gunpowder in there as well. So that's just another point about the Lords, and it's very glamorous inside. It's more glamorous than the Commons Chamber, actually. And whilst I haven't met the Prime Minister, there was one day when there was lots of paparazzi outside of Parliament, and I thought, this is a bit odd. I just rushed into the office and did some work, and it got to lunchtime, and I thought, oh, better get outside, get some sunshine. When initially, when I first started, I wasn't leaving the estate. I was kind of just doing my work, but actually going for a lunchtime walk is something that's quite important to me. So I broke the mold and I started building that into my routine. And as I left the office, I came in through another entrance where there was so many paparazzi here. And as I'm walking to the building, someone turns around and goes, whoa. So they mistook me for someone else, but I still made it to the front page of the paper. No, I'm joking. I didn't really, but that was quite a funny moment. It's not every day you walk past. It's not every day that happens.
No, it certainly isn't. And as you were talking, I was thinking, oh, I wonder what the House of Lords smells like. The House of Commons smells like. Does it smell like leather, or does it just smell like lots of sweat and kind of people that need a shower? How does it smell?
No, well, it's of course, there's the history within the whole parliamentary estate. There isn't really a distinctive smell, but there are really good services within the parliamentary estate. Lots of restaurants, lots of cafes. There's even a place you can get your haircut. I actually had a parliamentary haircut recently. I didn't ask for, you know, the politician's cut. I kind of went for my usual style. So, it doesn't
Perhaps
have a smell.
Did you Boris's hairdresser?
No, I didn't. not quite. There isn't a smell necessarily, but there is a sense of, you know, there's lots of meetings going on, and there's a sense of there's lots of stuff happening. If anything, it's a surprise there isn't smell of sweat and things like that.
Yes, it sounds like really buzzy. It sounds alive. It sounds vibrant. You know, and it feels a little bit like when you go to an arena venue and there's like all those shops and cafes and stuff out just outside that you can kind of, so you don't ever need to leave. You know, it feels like they've created a town in Westminster itself.
Definitely. And one of the funny things is, I didn't actually realise that from one of the buildings, there's a tunnel under the road which enables you to get into the more into the kind of parliamentary estate where the Westminster Hall and the Commons and the Lords is. And on that first day, when you go under the road and you see the gargoyles and you see the arches, I kind of had to pinch myself in some ways, because it was such a an amazing experience. And when you do step outside of the estate and you see the London Eye and the river, it's just such a nice place to be working right in central London. So I try to make more of a mindful intention of just taking in the surroundings inside the estate and outside, just to really ground myself in that as well. So if you like mindfulness, I think it's a brilliant place to practice, because you could literally spot something new every time you're walking around.
It really does sound amazing, and it's making me think of the first time I ever got my first badge that said assistant psychologist. And I was working for St Andrew's Healthcare at the time, and they used to give out these really beautiful gold metal badges. So you put on your shiny gold metal badge, it said assistant psychologist, and I just couldn't believe that my swipe card would get me into this incredible building, because it's in a really, really historic building. And I'm feeling like the same is true of you know, having a swipe pass that gets you legally into this really amazing building full of history, full of it either past now or unfolding right now. It sounds like just lots and lots of pinch me moments.
It's funny, actually, when I received my pass and I could walk around on my own, because if you don't have a pass, you've just got a visitor's pass, you need to be accompanied. And I finally got my pass and I thought, oh, I can walk around on my own. I'm not sure where I want to go, if I'm going to get stopped. There's men with guns everywhere, men and women with guns. And I thought, no, I just need to go out this way. Even if I walk the wrong way, I'm sure it will be fine. And I'm still here to tell the story, so that's fine.
That's really cool. When I started working in a youth prison, I actually wasn't allowed to work there to begin with, because I had to have Ministry of Defence clearance, where they went through every single reference, including my primary school, to check that I was who I said I was, and that there wasn't any unaccounted for time. I had to get a letter written to say that I actually was traveling the world when I was backpacking for 6 months. Like, literally couldn't be a single gap that wasn't unreferenced. Did they do something similar for Parliament, or a little bit happier for you to float under the radar?
No, it's quite a extensive check as well. I remember I shouldn't have been surprised, actually, but it was a bit when I had to fill in this kind of security form. I had to message my parents and find out where they were born and a few extra details. And I thought, this is it's understandable, really. It sounds like you would be able to get in here as well, Marianne, if you ever fancy a change of career. You've already got quite an extensive security clearance by the sounds of it. So one step closer.
I can bear that in mind for when I'm Prime Minister. What will be your lasting impression from this placement with you, do you think, as you consider it now? Obviously it may change in future.
That's a really nice question to be asked, because for me, I always like to think about how would I like to think with the end in mind. What would I like the final outcome to be? And I think in terms of my lasting impression of Parliament, I think it will be one of feeling very fortunate to have had the time working in there, to be honest, just from knowing how it works. And I can imagine in the future visiting London, if I move out of London, hopefully with a family, walking around and thinking, oh, yeah, worked in there, let's try and get a tour. And it'll be quite an exciting place to visit as well. And one that was quite perhaps formative for me in terms of shaping the way that I want to work as a psychologist as well, because it's given me quite a lot of exposure to different areas, not just psychology and health, but a understanding of different professions. And I think there's so much out there, which as a psychologist, I knew from 16 what I wanted to do. And that was kind of my tunnel vision on that goal. But actually, it's kind of taught me there's so much out there. So I feel very fortunate to have had the experience.
Oh, that's a very humbling end. That's really, really lovely. It's just been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. And I think people will take many things from what we've spoken about. But I think if you are in a professional qualification where there are optional placements where you can choose what you want to do. You don't necessarily have to pick something out of a book. Like, if you know where you want to go, you can create that for yourself. And I think when I was in training, some people even had out of catchment placements. All they had to be able to do was evidence that that wasn't available in their locality. And so if people are interested in creating their own placements, I think what you've really nicely demonstrated, that is possible even if there is no precedent for it.
I think it's something that you need to be careful with, because of course not everyone can start approaching supervisors. I think that will become quite uncontaining. But I think, like you said, if there's not what you want to do in your area and that you're quite confident that's what you want to go into, then I think there's a strong case for making that happen, because I think there's a lot of research which shows where you spend your final year placement or research, that dictate, not dictates, but there's a high likelihood of entering working in that place, which, as I said that out loud, I've started thinking about what that means for me. So not sure if that's where I'll end up in the future too.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what my final year placements were. They were psychodynamic with adults and then systemic and solution focus, lifespan service, I would say. But actually, my qualifying job was determined by the fact it was recession and there weren't any jobs. So I ended up in CAMHS for 4 years, but had a delightful time in doing that. Anyway, I digress. It's been so lovely to speak with you. Please do consider coming back and chatting to us when you're qualified so that we can see where you end up and whether you do kind of go further down the political route. It'd be fascinating to see the next stage in your journey.
Well, yeah, so thank you so much for having me, Marianne. And I think, see, I'm a year-long placement as well, so seeing how I finish the last couple of months will be helpful. I mean, unless the election is called early, which I think there's the working assumption apparently is it will be in the second half of this year, it should be therefore a year-long placement for me as well. So it would be fantastic to come back and give an update both at the end and in the future as well. So yeah, thank you for having me, Marianne.
Oh, thank you. I'm wishing you the very best with getting your thesis finished and passing your viva with flying colours. I too have heard that getting your systematic review published before your viva is a pretty good way to go. So yeah, wishing you luck with that. I think it's your organisational skills that are gonna probably make that happen. Other methods are also available and are okay too. But yeah, thank you so much for your time, Bradley.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Gosh, what an absolute privilege to speak with Bradley. I feel like I've learned so much and I'm so energized. And, I am totally gonna try and book in to go and see him and have my own lovely swanky tour of Westminster. He thanked me for what I've been doing these last few years in psychology for aspiring psychologists, and that was humbling. It's lovely. It's lovely to think that what I do is useful to you as my listeners and my viewers. And I would love your thoughts. I would love your feedback. The idea that I'm helping you in any way is just the biggest privilege, the biggest pleasure. And because I know I would have found this sort of content really useful when I was an aspiring psychologist. Heck, I find it useful and interesting now, So yeah, thank you for allowing me to keep doing what I do, keep gracing your ears, and if you're watching on YouTube, your eyes with this content. Please do consider also the Aspiring Psychologist Collective book, the Clinical Psychologist Collective book, and of course, if it matters to you that people are able to access qualified and regulated therapists, mental health professionals, please do also bear in mind the brand new book called Talking Heads, which is people's guide to help them find qualified and regulated therapists in the UK. If you have got any ideas for future podcast episodes, please don't be shy. Come and connect with me on my socials. I am Dr. Marianne Trent everywhere. If you'd like to get involved with the debates about psychologist title being a protected title, please do come and find me on Instagram specifically and LinkedIn, which I am Dr. Marianne Trent in both of those places, of course, too. Love to hear your voice on this. Let's see what we can do, as Bradley suggested, to get the public behind this cause, because that might just be the difference that makes the difference. One of the reasons I do what I do is that I passionately believe in psychology as a professionally qualified profession. I don't want you guys to get to be qualified or to get further along your journey and to feel like it doesn't matter, or that others are getting, you know, more kudos for what they're doing when they are not at all qualified or experienced, you know. So I care about what you do. I care about you being able to ease the distress of people you work with as well, and about you having a long, happy, healthy career in psychology. That's the dream, right? I will look forward to catching up with you for our next episode of the podcast, which as an MP3 is available from 6 a.m. on Mondays. And as a YouTube episode, you get a little sneaky extra. It's usually available on Saturdays. So I'm also Dr. Marianne Trent on YouTube. Please do subscribe. Please do like. Please do tell your friends. Take care. If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. With this podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast with Dr. Marianne Trent.
My name is Diakolola Amujo. I am a recent psychology graduate from Ireland. I am also an aspiring clinical psychologist. Dr. Marianne's book, The Clinical Psychologist Collective, has been so helpful to me on this journey to becoming a clinical psychologist. As I plan to continue postgraduate studies in the UK, I found it extremely useful that this book provided in-depth information on the UK DClinSci application process. I enjoyed reading about the experiences of both qualified and trainee clinical psychologists. The various narratives were my favorite part of the book, as everyone's story was different and it provided amazing insights into the clinical psychology journey. I would definitely recommend this book to anyone interested in psychology and aspires to become a clinical psychologist.